Lord, I just really want to thank you for the amazing privilege it was over those last 2 weeks for me to wrestle with a really powerful passage. And I just want to ask, Lord, that some of the things that you've taught me, some of the things I've read and listened to, and some of the things that you've stirred up in my own life, that I could just be your agent this morning as we walk through these passages to be able to help encourage people to think again about who you are and what you've done for us. So thanks for the opportunity to gather together this morning. In Jesus' name we thank you. Amen. All right, we're working through the series in the book of Mark, and we're sort of coming to the last couple of weeks. And one of the things I thought about when I looked at this was I thought, you know, you look at these last 2.5 chapters, and it's one heavy message after another. And I thought at some point, people are going to get sick of this stuff, but it seems like people are really into this stuff. And I tell you what, it's been a huge blessing for us as pastors to be able to walk through this stuff slowly and methodically, because it's just a very, very important section of Scripture. And so this morning we're coming to this section in Mark. It's chapter 14, verses 53 through 65. And the title of it is, I called it God in the Dock. When I was just a young skull full of mush going to Bible college, and I'm still an old skull full of mush, but I was really a skull full of mush then. And I went to Bible college, and I didn't start going to church till I was in high school. And so, like, all of those stories that you hear and learn when you're young and in Sunday school, I didn't get any of that. And I got pieces of it, you know, going through youth group and going to church on Sunday. But I went to Bible college, and I'm still reading the Bible, and I'm reading these stories, and I'm just like, whoa. I mean, there's all this new stuff every week that I'm learning. And so my freshman year, one of my elective classes I took was from a lady named Dr. Rebecca Rodmacher. And she had her doctorate from doing her research about, you know, C.S. Lewis, about his life and writings. And so if you've been a Christian for very long, you probably know that name. He's very popular. He's written some very popular books. And I knew that, I had heard that name enough to know that he was someone important, but I hadn't read any of his books. So I thought, well, this is a great opportunity for me to hear about somebody that everybody else says is important. So I started taking this class, and one of the things that she gave us as work was to take one of C.S. Lewis's works and read them and do a report on them. And so that was, you know, one of the very first couple of weeks of class. And so, you know, I'm sorting through all of these essays and books. I mean, he did a tremendous amount of writing. And I chose this short book that had these theological essays in it called God in the Dock. Now, I got it because I was from Monterey, and I love surfing, I love the water, I like boats. And I figured, well, a dock must mean, you know, a place, it's got to be about boats or the water or whatever. So that's why I picked this out. And I'm reading through this stuff, and I'm halfway through these essays, and not one mention of boats, harbors, water, or anything like that. I'm like, this is a major gyp, man. And I remember, about halfway through the essay, I went and I asked the professor, I said, Dr. Rodmacher, I said, I picked this because I was assuming at some point there would be something nautical in here, right? And she kind of, I could tell she didn't want to laugh, but she was, you know, it was funny to her. And she said to me, she said, well, what have you been reading about? I kind of explained to her about people having these questions that they would ask God. And she said, well, what are they doing there? And I said, I don't know. It sounds like people are making accusations about God. And she said, that's exactly what's going on in these essays, is this is about people putting God on trial. And these are essays about putting God on trial for the state and fate of the world. And the dock is an old English term for the witness stand. And I was like, oh. But I really wasn't comforted because I wanted to read about boats and nautical things. So this idea, I read the rest of that stuff, and it was really fascinating to me, this idea of putting God on trial. And I remember at that time I was thinking, that's bizarre. Who would ever have the audacity to put the God of the universe on trial and make him stand in the place of judgment? That just didn't make any sense to me. Well, it's not a new theme. In 1957, shortly after World War II, this East German pastor, his name is Günter Rutenborn, and he's an East German pastor, and he wrote this very short play called The Sign of Jonah. And it's about that very idea, though, about putting God on trial. Because a lot of people in Germany, you know, several years after the war, were starting to wrestle with the atrocities and the depth of the atrocities, and they were trying to figure out who's to blame for this. And Time Magazine did an article on this because the play this pastor put on, which was just a very small production put on by amateurs, ends up running 1,000 times in West Berlin because the messaging it was so powerful. So it's in this play, it was written in this church, and the sort of the main thesis is who's to blame for World War II and the atrocities. And it's a story about this group of refugees, and they're arguing as they're traveling about who's to blame for the horror. And, of course, sort of they go through the usual process. And the first question is, well, is it just the average citizen's fault? And they go, well, no, of course not. It's not our fault. It wasn't our friend's fault. It was the German soldiers who carried this stuff out. They're to blame. And of course, what happens is some of the soldiers are there, and they say, no, we're not to blame. We were just following orders. It was the officer's responsibility, not ours, for what happened. And of course, there were a couple of officers in this group, and they go, no, it's not our fault. It's because of the system, the people that were making the munitions and the manufacturers who were financing Hitler and the war. And there actually happened to be some of those people there, and they go, no, it wasn't because of the businesses. They're not to blame. It's because of the party officials. And on and on and on it goes. Suddenly, a man comes up out of the crowd, and he says, do you want to know who's really to blame for all the suffering we've been going through? I'll tell you. God is to blame. God created this world. God placed all of this power in such unworthy hands. God allowed all of this to happen. And at first, everybody was like taken aback by this accusation, but gradually the chorus was picked up by all the people. God is to blame. God is to blame. God is to blame. So they put him on trial, and finally the judge decides to blame God. And God is found guilty and sentenced to walk the earth until he dies. Now, why is that? Why was that play so powerful? Because it in some regards, it draws on something I think most people go through in their life, and that is they don't want to take responsibility for their own actions, and we're always looking to pass it on. And at the very end of that line, very oftentimes we find the last person to blame is God. And I remember when I was in Bible college, this odd story actually is in the Bible in a couple places. The first place is in this book, the book of Exodus in the Old Testament, and it's a story of this group of people that are wandering in the wilderness, and they just come from God doing amazing, amazing miracles in their midst. And he set them free, and he's taking them to a new land, and they're in the desert, and they decide it's just too hard for us. There isn't enough food, there isn't enough water, and they're grumbling. And so they call the leader, who's a guy named Moses, and they call Moses before him, and they say, what did you do? Bring us out here to die? There's no water. This is a horrible situation. Moses is frustrated. He's like, do you not recall all that God has done for you? And God says to Moses, don't worry. We'll call an assembly. Call the people before me. And you can imagine Moses is rubbing his hands together going, now these grumbling people are going to get it. They've asked for it, and they're going to get it. So they assemble at this place, and there is this rock. And the bizarre thing is something that has never happened in the history of the Old Testament happens here, where typically God calls the people before him to give an account for what they've done. But in this story, Moses calls the people, and God, the language is reversed, God stands before them to give an account. And it's very much like this picture of putting God on trial. Now, God is represented in this story by a rock, fittingly, which is sort of an appropriate way of thinking about who God is. And Moses has this rod, and a rod in the Old Testament was for measuring, and it was a rod that they used to measure judgment, to pass, a sign of justice. And Moses takes the rod, and God tells him to strike, and the word is smite, the rock, judge, pass judgment on the rock. And Moses does that. And the funny thing is the people that were deserving of being smitten themselves for their whining and complaining, they're doubting the very God who's done all of this for them, that God stands before them. He's the one who stands in the place of judgment. He is judged. And the bizarre thing about this is rather than the rock exploding and killing everybody, the opposite thing happens. The rock breaks and life giving water, a blessing, pours out to the people that absolutely deserve the opposite. God strikes himself, and in striking himself and judging himself, it becomes a blessing to the people. Now, the story that we're going to read today in the book of Mark is the story of God being put on trial. And there's obviously there's nothing more dramatic in life than a trial where the defendant is standing before the judges with his life on the line. And so this is what we find here after Jesus has been arrested. This is the first of several sort of mock trials. So if you open your Bible, you can follow along with me. And starting in verse 53, this is what we find out. And they led Jesus. I didn't show you that. Sorry about that. That was the Time magazine cover in 1957 that had the article about this. Okay, so verse 53. And they led Jesus to the high priest, and all of the chief priests and elders and the scribes came together. Now, this is language for them of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was a group of 70 rulers and plus the high priest. The high priest at the time, his name is Joseph. His surname, of course, in the Bible, there was this guy named Caiaphas. Now, the high priest, you would think, would be elected by the Jewish people, but he wasn't. He was elected by the Roman government to sort of help ride herd over the Jewish people. And they tried to pick somebody that the Jews respected, but who would still be obedient to Rome and the Roman authorities. And so this guy Caiaphas, he's an interesting guy because he served for 19 years. And he was obviously very politically savvy because the average tenure of somebody serving in that position was about 4 years. So he had a very long reign in this position because he somehow sort of knew how to get the people together and still have them do what Rome wanted to. So this is this language. These people bring this guy, Jesus, before the Sanhedrin. And we find out that they are meeting at Caiaphas's house. And just to kind of give you an idea of what this was is, give you an orientation here. So like if you think about where Jesus was arrested was in the Mount of Olives outside the city because the city's packed full of people, no room for the people that are there pilgrimaging there. So a lot of people slept outside. That's why Jesus is in this garden. That's where he gets arrested. The temple, which is the scene of all of this confrontation that has led up to this arrest with the religious leader, it happens at the temple, which is sort of at the northeast part of the city. And then Caiaphas's house is down in the southwest part of the city. Now, the place where trials were supposed to take place is actually very near the temple. So right away, if you read this stuff and you knew a lot about Jewish history, you'd go, well, that's not right, because they're not allowed to have any sort of official trial anywhere other than where the Sanhedrin met. And so right away, you'd go kind of suspicious. Well, this is sort of an odd thing that's going on here. And so we're introduced to the person of Peter, because Peter's been hanging out, and it said that Peter had followed him at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. In your bulletins here, there's a couple places to fill in blanks, and this is the first one. You know, it's in all four of the stories about this event, the story of Peter is told, and it's always told that Peter has come and he's sort of watching from a distance. He's sitting by this fire with Roman guards and some other servants in the courtyard of this house. And each one of them talks about there being a fire there, and he is warming himself at the fire. I couldn't help but think that Peter, of all people, who has spoken so vigilantly to stand guard, to be at Jesus' side, even till his death, that here's Peter standing at as a distance, reserved, warmth of a fire, a comfortable place, curious about what's going to happen. And I thought, you know, this is what Christianity is like for so many people. And it's like this for me very oftentimes. That what ends up happening is I can come to church on Sunday and I'll sing this song that Bruce sang. I'll take me to the cross. I'll follow you. This is what my life's going to be all about. Only to get into the middle of the week and the challenges and the demands of our time and our energy and the opportunities to compromise, the difficulty of actually doing what nobody else seems to want to do, to live a life of integrity that would honor God, becomes very difficult. And very often as we find as that pressure rises, it's just easier to observe. It's easier to stand at a distance. It's easier to watch. And the first key here, the first life lesson in here is I think that very oftentimes honoring God means leaving the warmth of the fire. See, Christianity was never meant to be a spectator sport where just a couple of people play and other people just watch what's going on. So one of the things that I really don't like about church on Sundays is I don't, you know, people ask me, well, do you like preaching? You know what? I hate this. I don't, you know, you might be thinking about a date you've got tonight, or you're seeing your kids this week. You might be hearing me and you're thinking one thing and I'm going down this path, and I have no way of interacting with you to know. That's why I like doing small group Bible study stuff, because I like interaction. I like talking with people. I have no idea what people are. I feel like this is not what Christianity is supposed to be about. It's not supposed to be about people coming and watching and one person or a couple people play. This is the opposite of what Christianity is supposed to be about, where let me watch and you guys all go do it, right? That's what Christianity is supposed to be about. And see, Peter in this represents this picture of, it's so easy to talk the big talk. Oh, take me to the cross. I'll be there. I'll follow. But when push comes to shove, it's just easier to stand with the crowd and keep our hands warm than it is to get dirty and busy and leave the fire to where it might be a real challenge for us. So the crux of this whole passage and these really events right here come right here, where the priests are looking for an opportunity to put Jesus to death. And this should be no mystery, because we've been told about this over and over and over again as we lead up to this story, that the chief priests, the whole council, they're seeking testimony against Jesus. They don't want to just get, I mean, they're not just looking for an opportunity to put the guy in prison. They want to get rid of him. They don't understand him. He's a challenge to their authority and their power and their influence over the people. And they want him. They're seriously threatened by him. They feel like he is a person leading people away from God, and they want to get rid of him. Verse 56 tells us, "For many people bore false witness against him, but their testimony didn't agree. Some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, 'We heard him say, I'll destroy this temple that was made with hands, and in 3 days I'll build another, not made with human hands.'" And what they do is they sort of take a conglomeration of some of the things that Jesus has said, twist them a little bit to make it sound like what Jesus is saying is God is against the temple and it's going to be destroyed, which actually will come to pass in 40 years. But that's not at all if you go back and read what Jesus said. They can't even get their testimonies, their false testimonies right. But yet, even about their testimonies, they did not agree. Verse 60, the high priests are frustrated at this point because they're trying to gin up this charge to get it to stick on Jesus, that he's been saying, God's against you, he's going to destroy the temple. The high priest stood up, he's not happy about this, in the midst of it, and he asked Jesus, "Have you no answer to make? What is it these men testify against you?" And Jesus, so this is a big question, and Jesus doesn't answer. And this is something we'll find out that Jesus will do, and obviously in some respects it's a fulfillment of prophecy. But more than that, the Jewish legal system wasn't all that unlike ours, where a witness didn't have to bear testimony against himself. He didn't have to implicate himself. And Jesus is like, his question would have been, "What do you want me to answer? You brought this litany of people. They can't even agree about what the charges should be. So what do you want me to answer? You don't have any charges. What am I going to say here?" Now, there's something that really ought to be disturbing if you know the story well, and that is that this whole trial is really, it's a sham, and it's a total abuse of the Jewish legal system, which was set out so well in Deuteronomy. And if anybody followed rules and took rules seriously, it was who? The leaders, the Jewish leaders. Everything that they had was measured by these laws. And it wasn't just to be mean, guys, but they said, these laws help us to know how to live in a way to honor God. They took these laws, they took these teachings very, very seriously. Now, here's the funny thing, though. Their desire, their goal, is to kill Jesus, because they're convinced that he is leading people astray. But I want you to see the means that they will go about to get that end, because it's deeply troubling for people that cared about the law. Their desire is to get rid of Jesus, but I want you to look at how they go about doing this and how little regard they have for their own standards. The first thing is that you weren't allowed to have any kind of legal proceedings during Passover. That was a no-no. So they break that law. There were supposed to be no trials at night. They had a set time, and it was during the day, and it wasn't just because of the corruption of night, but because they wanted people to be at their full senses, and they wanted to do trials during the day. So they weren't allowed to do trials at night. The trials required to take place in a court. This is not in the court. This isn't even in their official meeting place. So they would have said, well, this is an exception for an exceptional case. So we'll overlook that rule. Well, they overlook every rule in coming to bring Jesus before them. They had to have two agreeing witnesses for any sort of capital case. So if they want to bring, if they want to put Jesus to death or recommend him to be put to death, you had to have two witnesses that agreed on the crime. They didn't even have that. The Sanhedrin could only investigate evidences. Think about this. If you go to a courtroom, how weird would it be to have the judge stand up and interrogate the person? See, that's what's going on here. They, in their legal system, Jesus was supposed to have an advocate. They were supposed to have someone who brought the evidence against them who wasn't a part of the court. But they're doing the opposite. They are the judges, and they're standing in judgment. How is that justice at all? Not only that, there were no appointed lawyers, like I told you. In any capital case that they recommended to the Roman government, because they couldn't carry out executions themselves, the Roman government gave them a great deal of latitude, but they couldn't execute anybody. But in order to hand somebody off, there had to be a 24-hour period between when the case was heard and when he was put to death. Now, some people might argue, some Jewish scholars might argue, well, this is just an arraignment hearing. Well, if that's true, and the morning was the actual trial, which again didn't take place where it was supposed to take place, there was no 24 hours between that and where Jesus was put to death. All of these things, they have this system, they have these rules because they thought these things govern how we live. But they said, you know what, we want this and we want it so bad that we're willing to violate rule after rule after rule after rule that they set up. And see, here's the bottom line about all this. Why did they do this? They'd already made up their minds. They didn't care about the trial. They didn't care about the legality of it. They had their idea set up as to what they desired, and they didn't care what the means were to achieve it. Now, anybody who reads this has to, in some level, go, those guys are despicable. These are the people that are supposed to uphold integrity and justice, on, you know, be God's people to lead the people. What a sad situation. And you know, the easiest thing to do is impugn these guys because they have not only a bad end in mind, but their means to get it is atrocious. But I want you to think just for a minute. What if you substitute the word they, and you put in the place of that, you put yourself? Is it possible that in your own life, you've done the same thing? You've got a desire, something you want, and you're convinced it's the right thing? Only your means to go about getting it might be suspect. You might fudge on your taxes because you want a little bit more money, because you want to be able to take care of your family better. You're just too stretched to be able to do that. Or maybe you embellish a story about yourself to gain respect in the eyes of other people. In a good situation, you know, I found myself in staff meeting a couple weeks ago, and there was opportunity, people were telling stories, and I had this story that was similar to a story that other people were telling, and I thought, well, I could just embellish it a little bit because it'll make me look more godly in the eyes of the other people at staff. Just, you know, and I'm a pastor, and it's a good thing to be respected as a pastor, so maybe sometimes we'll embellish a story just to make ourselves look better or impress other people. Or somehow that will garner us respect. Or how about this? What if you took small liberties in a job interview? Maybe you withheld some information that would have been important to the person making the decision. Or maybe you, again, embellished a little bit about your past in order to help you get a job. But it's a good thing because you want the job. And the job will help bring provision for your family. Maybe you're like me and you're just good at manipulation. And you know how to manipulate people with the right words, with the right emotional pull to be able to get what you want. And see, here's the thing about this. What they did is something all of us do in life. We want something, and we're convinced it's the right thing. But you know what? Here's what living a life of integrity is all about. And I want to tell you why integrity is such a big deal. Because we're not just physical beings that experience physical pain when we break rules. You know, you can do something that defies the law of gravity, and you're going to get hurt as a result of that, right? And so we understand that. There's these laws that govern how we live, and if we violate them, they're going to hurt us physically. But you see, we are spiritual people also. And when we violate The moral codes from which God intended for us to live at peace with ourselves, at peace with other people, and certainly peace with Him. When we violate those things, there is every bit as real a pain and consequences as there are when we violate physical laws in the world. That's why living with some sense of integrity is important. And that's why God says not just what you get in the end is important, but it's important for you to ask yourself, why am I doing this? What are my motivations? And even if you figure out that this is a good thing, it's something we desire for the right reasons, very oftentimes you can go about getting it the wrong way. We have our pastor's meeting this week. We're sitting there talking, and I proposed something, and Dan wasn't there, fortunately, so it was real easy to snow job the other guys. And I presented something to them, and they go, you know what, that makes sense. That's a no-brainer. That would be a good thing for our church. And I talked about the motivations for it, and the motivations, totally legit good things. We all agreed. But you know what? We were really hung up on what's the right way to start walking down the path to get to that end. Because there were a lot of options to do it. And we really had a hard time figuring out what's the moral way to honor God and other people to achieve that end. See, and this is why people say Christianity is just easy. It's just following a bunch of rules and regulations. See, being a Christian is about whole life. And people who take whole life living seriously, thinking about your motivations, thinking about the different options to achieve an end, it's a wrestling match. It's a hard thing. So it's easy to condemn those guys, but I think it's easy. It's the hard thing is to realize that what we condemn in them, sometimes we're guilty of in our own lives. So again, this really is the climax of this whole thing. Again, the high priest questioned him, and they said, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? They're not asking Jesus if he's God, but they're asking him that question of Blessed One. Are you the person sent by God to be our deliverer from the Romans? They weren't expecting him to say that he was God. That's not what they're asking him. They're just saying, are you the promised person that God sent? Now, this is a big, big question. Jesus' life hangs in the balance here, although his life very well may have already been decided. But his answer is huge. And he gives them way more than they bargained for. And he says, I am. And you'll see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. And what Jesus does here is, they're just asking, hey, are you the person sent by God to help us get out of the power of the Romans? You know, be a great spiritual teacher? And Jesus says to him, he says, I'm the person that regardless of what you do right now will be vindicated by God, and I will sit at his right hand in power. And Jesus is taking two Old Testament passages that the people all understood were talking about this figure that would come at the end of time that would be the judge. And so he takes this picture of, you can judge me right now, but God will vindicate me because I'll be sitting at his right hand, and I will come back in the clouds. Now to them, you know, clouds to us, that's mist and vapor and that kind of stuff. Jesus is talking in a way here that they all understood from Daniel chapter 7, that this is the glory of God, the clouds of the very glory of who God is. Jesus would be coming back in that to judge them. Now this elicits an explosion from them because they realize Jesus isn't just claiming to be a special person sent by God. But in saying, I'm the person who's going to come back and I have the power not only to be vindicated, but I'll be the person who comes back and judge. And they all understood that the person who was going to judge, the only person who had that authority was God himself. Jesus gives them this enormous answer that they were not ready for at all. And it really does lead to this explosion. Listen to their reaction. The high priest tore his garments. What further witnesses do we need? You've heard this blasphemy. They understood Jesus wasn't just claiming to be a nice guy or a great moral teacher. They understood. See, this is a sign of grief. You couldn't tear your robes because of your own personal grief. So like if your child died, that's personal grief. You weren't allowed to rip your clothes for that. But someone who had said something against that defamed God, which, you know, that was the sort of thing that caused the kind of grief that you could rip your clothes as a sign of that. What's your decision? They all condemned him as deserving to death. Some of them began to spit on him and cover his face and strike him, saying to him, prophesy. And the guards received him with blows. See, now this is a very actually appropriate reaction. Because they didn't think that Jesus is just claiming to be some great moral teacher. They understood that what he was saying to them was a total abomination of everything they believed about who this guy was, that he had the audacity to claim to be God himself. C.S. Lewis, in talking about why, when you take seriously what Jesus said about who he is, why it should elicit a strong reaction, either to run and fall at the knees of Jesus, or to do this, to be totally incensed by what Jesus says. C.S. Lewis says it so well. He says, "I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying a really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That's the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things that Jesus said wouldn't be a great moral teacher. He'd either be a lunatic on the level of a man who says he's a poached egg, or he'd be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or he's a madman or something worse. You can shut him up as a fool, you can spit on him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any great patronizing nonsense about him being a great human teacher. He hasn't left that open to us, and he didn't intend to." And I think that that's a very, very appropriate way of understanding exactly what Jesus said about who he was and what his business on earth was all about. I told you at the beginning that, you know, part of what you see in this is this very bizarre picture of God being put on trial by people. Who would have the audacity to do that? But what's even crazier to me than that is this. Why would God allow himself to be put on trial? Why would he go through that exercise? What would that be about? And see, to understand this, you've got to understand this great thing that is happening here. There's both a big problem with humanity, and there's this bizarre blessing. And it all has to do with substitution. See, the problem that we all have is that word that the Bible uses called sin, which is a rejection of God's authority. And what it is, see, God was meant to occupy the throne of our lives, where our decisions, our understanding of right and wrong, our priorities and values were made to be set by him. But what we've done, sin, is we substitute that. And we say, I'll decide what's right and wrong. I'll sit on the throne of my life and I'll make my own decisions. I'll choose my own priorities, my own values. And what God says ultimately is far less important than what I do. That's putting yourself, that's substituting yourself for the place of God. And that's the problem of sin. And God had to do something about this if there was any hope of us being able to be reconciled and forgiven for this problem that we all suffer for. And see, this is where that second part of substitution comes in, which we find right here, which is salvation. Instead of sitting as judge, which God should have done, Jesus substitutes himself in our place of guilt. So the shame, the judgment that was due me, he was willing to take on himself. He substitutes himself, the person who knew no sin, who did nothing wrong, takes my place. He receives the judgment that was bore me. And here's the flip part of that substitution. Check this out. We receive the blessings that the good son, the obedient person, deserved to have. And it only happens because Jesus was willing to do this for us. See, Moses didn't understand this. The people come before him, and Moses says, "You're going to get it now," but God strikes himself, and rather than judgment, the people get what they don't deserve. That's what we call grace or blessing, getting what you don't deserve. I want to tell you that as I thought about this here this last couple of days, we talk about grace a lot in church, and it's done from the perspective of oftentimes the way I'll explain it is God gives me a gift and I get what I don't deserve, which is certainly what happens here in this picture of substitution and Jesus being willing to put on trial in my place and receive all of this. But you know what? I read this week. You know, I just said, no, God, no. Because the flip side of grace is understanding that not only did I get what I didn't deserve, but Jesus got what I deserved. And it's enough for me to be able to go, wow, that's a great gift for me. But I don't want him to be punished on my behalf. That's exactly what happened. And the very people that should have been most excited about God's coming to them, the leaders, were the first people to spit on him and ridicule him and mock him. And, you know, typically, at the end of a message, you know, I tell you, here are some things you can sort of take away from this, but I think you're probably smart enough to figure this out. So I want to put the last verse up here and let you read it and allow God so you can understand and think again about his goodness and what he did for you. Lord, thanks for bearing our shame and guilt upon yourself. And thank you for being so good to us and entering into the world in such a practical way and suffering right alongside us. You know what grief is all about. And we thank you for your willingness to substitute yourself for us. Help us to leave the comfort of the fire to serve you well this week. In Jesus' name, amen.